This is the Truth Frequency Radio Network.
We are TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.
Australia and all around the world, wherever you may be, I'm your host, Nikki Colombo, and welcome to the Nikki Colombo Show. Tonight we have a very special guest on. Michelle M. Deschamps is on, and he is a former MUFON member and former provincial section director of Sunbury, Ontario, Canada. And since July 1974, he has had 27 separate UFO sightings, including two captured on video. He has appeared on numerous radio and television programs, including Midday Q in the North, MCTV Today, three local stations, Vault TFO, and the Camilla Scott Show CTV, just to name a few. He was also featured in local press, which includes the Sunbury Star, the Northern Life, the Lambda-Laurentian University publication, the Cambrian Shield, Cambrian College publication, and the South Side Story. He's contributed valuable information to American researcher Jan Aldrich Project's 1947, which earned him an acknowledgement of his work in Jan's book Project 1947, a preliminary report on the 1947 UFO sighting wave. He continues to inform the public about UFOs and flying saucers by lecturing on the subject, and has written several letters to the editor about his and other people's eyewitness accounts. He also wrote a few articles which have appeared in the Canadian Ufologist, the MUFON Ontario's new letter, now defunct. His expertise lies in researching Northern Ontario newspaper archives for UFO reports and UFO-related information. Apart from those retrieved from the Sunbury Star, both he and his colleague, Todd Fraser, have located hundreds of new clippings within the pages of the Sault Star, the Timmins Daily Press, the Kirkland Lake Northern Daily News, and the North Bay Nugget. Since 2007, he has worked on creating a website originally based on the research that he did using the newspaper archive at Laurentian University, NUFORS, NOUFORS, Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study, has expanded to include a wide range of ufological, I'll say that with marbles in your mouth, guys, ufological information gathered from international sources, everything from sightings made by astronauts and police officers to physical trace evidence left by landed objects of unknown origin. He presents the hard facts to the best of his abilities and encourages the reader to look at the material with an open mind. Oh, you got a lot of those here, that's for sure, sweetie. With an open mind and perhaps learning something new and fascinating along the way. So welcome, Michelle, to the show. Woohoo!
Thank you, Nikki.
Oh, it's an honour to have you on here. Sweetie, do you want to start by telling us, how did this all start for you?
That's a question that's been asked many times. I'm not sure if it was the sighting that came first when I was 9 years old or the interest. I would say probably the sighting. And then I started researching a few years after that. But that initial first sighting wasn't really confirmed until many, many years later when I bought a book at a secondhand bookstore. And it turns out that there was a chapter about Sudbury, Ontario and Eastern Townships. And the dates matched pretty well, from my recollection, the date when I was in the area when I had my first sighting.
That seems to be the pattern with a lot of us where we have a lot of experiences when we're younger and we don't quite understand it, and it's not until years later when we start to do research that we start to join the dots, and then we realize and we start to go on this amazing journey of this fascinating subject that, you know, all my listeners are really involved with in so many different areas. What do you reckon?
It's pretty well the same across the board, whether you talk about ghost investigators or UFO investigators. I mean, I've looked into everything, Bermuda Triangle, Virgin Mary apparitions, ghosts, Bigfoot, UFOs became my specialty for some reason. I did not know I was going to have so many sightings that would convince me. Well, actually, I got convinced after the first 10 sightings. Before that, I wasn't too sure, but, it's across the board. And 9 years old, 9 years of age seems to be, a common thread as well for people who are into the paranormal. And, trust me, once you get into that world, it's pretty hard to close the floodgates, as they say.
I know. Do you know what? I've had many giggles with many of my guests. And I always reference Richard Dreyfuss from Close Encounters of the Third Kind and how obsessive and manic he was when he first had that sighting, and then he starts to build that big, you know, he gets all the pot plants and, you know, I mean, like, we weren't all that obsessive, but, you know, it's just such a fascinating subject. You can't put it down. It is something that triggers inside our DNA that wakes us up to the fact that we actually have galactic family out there, and there's good guys and there's, you know, there's negative guys, and we all have to navigate through these energies as we get older. But looking back in hindsight, it's a fantastic tool, isn't it? Because I remember when I was about 19, 20, and I found this some scoop mark just, you know, down the bottom, you know, right on my left ovary. And for years I didn't know what that was until, you know, much later, 20 years later, I realized, okay, scoop marks, missing time, all, you know, all the traditional patterns that, you know, that a lot of people talk about. And I thought, okay, I didn't realize that I was having contact such as at such a young age, and didn't realize what scoop marks were all about until much later on. And now that I've gotten right into the subject, it's a real passion for me. It's not as an obsession as for me as what I used to be years ago, when I tried to go around red pilling everyone because they would just freak out. And that's not the way to go about it. You have to kind of bring them in a little bit more gently, because it's frightening, because people don't really understand what's going on. But once they start to when you start to understand a lot of this information, all the fear is dissipated, and that's what this show is all about. So, okay, so let's go back to when you're 9 years of age. What did the ship look like? And then carry on from there about how you progressed into where you are today.
Well, actually, it wasn't a ship per se. Actually, it was a metallic sphere. Mm-hmm. And I would say maybe probably, in relation to my size at the time, I would say it was probably a meter in diameter. And it was floating up just above the tree line. And if I remember correctly, I think I looked at it wondering, like, okay, is it a tethered balloon? Is it an advertisement balloon? But there was no advertisement on it. There was no chain or rope tying it down to the ground. And at that time, all that was there was a couple of U-Haul trailers, like trailers that we can rent to move stuff around, like when you're moving from one residence to another or whatever. And then there was a gravel, a parking lot size area, just with maybe gravel, and now it's all built up with homes. And so I remember looking in that direction. I just happened to be at this building where they used to have finger painting for the young kids. And then on the second floor of this building is where the teenagers would hold their dances. And that building is no longer there, but I just happened to be outside. And the reason why I think it was the summer was because the reflection of the sun on the object, the fact that my brother's birthday was July 13th, and later on when I found that book, the sightings were between July 12th and July 15th, 1974.
Wow.
And so I'm assuming that it would have been a perfect place for my mom to shoo us out of the house and just go to the end of the street where we would do finger painting and stuff like that on my brother's birthday. And I just happened to be standing outside, leaning against the back wall. And that's when I noticed the object. Now, for a long time, I thought it was something maybe I copied off TV or just memorized from somewhere. I wasn't sure if I really had the sighting. But when I bought the book, not only was I surprised to find out that other people had had similar sighting, but at about the same time, there was a Canadian Pacific Airlines flight from Montreal to Winnipeg that just happened to be flying above Sudbury at that time. It encountered a 100-foot diameter disc, and the pilot took evasive maneuver twice and apparently had all the passengers look out the same side of the plane, look out the window, and they could all see the object. But this was only referenced in the book. I've never seen or found any documents anywhere related to that. But the regular sightings, like what I saw, the spherical objects, I did later on purchase 5 microfilm reels from our own National Archives, and I found 2 pages that pertain to that particular sighting.
Wow, isn't it amazing how big these ships really are? I don't think people realize until you actually see one in real life about how big these things really are.
And now silent too. I mean, if it was man-made, the noise would be tremendous.
Yes, exactly. You know? And how with my sightings, it's amazing how they just zip straight up into the sky, or they take a 90-degree angle and yeah, I can tell that they're going into some, you know, other dimension. And I've also seen them how they've just, they suck in, like it's like they become a light, like they power up, become a light, and then that light goes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and then kind of just sucks out, just like, you know, as if you're going down a drain or down a vortex and just the, you know, the ball gets smaller and smaller of light, and then it just kind of disappears. And you go, "Oh my God, that's just amazing!" And thank God I had people around me, because I'm like, "Did you see that?" And they're like, "See, but I'm not crazy after all." Okay, like that seems to be the same phrase that people say over and over and over again when you say to someone, "See, I told you, I'm not crazy after all, huh?" And we're not crazy, and that's why we're here documenting. A lot of people say we should be rewriting the history books. So we're doing that right now by, I have people on my show giving, like, these are actual witness testimonies, and a lot of people are writing books right now. So we are changing the course of history right now for the history books for our future generations, and that's why we're doing this show. Okay, so after that, did your brother see it, by the way, or were you the only one?
I was, as far as I know, I was the only one who saw it. I looked far to my left, and I saw a guy with a baseball glove and a bat and playing with a ball. That was it. He was just by himself out in the baseball field adjacent to the property where I was. But I think I was the only one at the time. I mean, but obviously the documents mention other people having seen these, what they described as bluish, silvery spheres maneuvering around.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. Now, okay, so then what happened after that?
After that, I didn't have a sighting until almost like 20 years later. 15, because I was 9 years old at that time, and my next sighting was when it was in the early 90s. It was October 1990, as a matter of fact, October 9th, and I was in my early 20s then. So, and plus, because we live close to an airport, I was already getting myself familiarized with airplanes, how they look at night, and helicopters and whatever else. And the radar base was also not far, exactly eye to eye level. If you went from one hilltop where the airport was located and look over to the other hilltop, you'd be exactly in line with the radar base, which is no longer there. But that's where eventually, at the end of my sighting, that's where the object was the very last time I saw it.
I've seen one that's been right. I was actually picking somebody up from the airport, and it was very late at night, and I was crossing the Tugan Bypass on the Gold Coast to go onto the Gold Coast Highway, and of course I missed the turnoff because this great big triangle black melted rock looking, you know, ship, just a huge ship just appeared straight in front of my eyes. And and I missed the turnoff, and the guy in the car said to me, "See, I'm not crazy after all." And I was absolutely flabbergasted. It was so close. And then I had to do a turnaround and come back again to try and get on the freeway. But, you know, my jaw was just dropped all the way. And, you know, it appeared. It was like it was waiting for me. It appeared, bang, and then it disappeared, bang. And I'm like, oh, my God. And because it was so late at night, there was nobody else on the road. So they kind of, you know, gave us a little bit of a hello there, and that was right near the airport. So there's must be something going on, some sort of correlation there, guys, with the airports and seeing these ships that kind of flash at you and then they disappear. It's like they're kind of saying, you know, hello, we're here. Whether or not it was back engineering or not, I'm not quite sure. Who knows? It's very hard to tell, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so after that, how did you get into MUFON? MUFON, guys, is when I first saw, for my Aussie audience, I'll have a bit of a giggle about this, but when I first saw that word MUFON, I didn't have my glasses on and I thought it was MUFON, and I was having a bit of a giggle about that for a long time. So now I hope you Americans understand exactly what I'm talking about there. But, yeah, we have a bit of a giggle about that and try and change the words around. But anyway, is there anything before you joined MUFON that is significant that you want to talk about?
Well, during high school, I actually put together what I call my easy access book, because whenever I would talk to some of my relatives or friends, I would be able to show them, yeah, some UFOs do leave vapor trails. Some UFOs do make noise, and you know, and it was almost an inch thick, and just like a collection taken from different books and stuff while I was in high school. And then after a while, I thought about it, and I said, well, what the hell am I going to do with all this? So I was working at a car dealership at the time in 1990, actually. A lot of things happened in 1990. The very same summer before that October month where I had my sighting at the radar base, I met a man by the name of, Don Campbell, but his nickname, his license plate said UFO Don. And he was at the dealership looking for a car in order to trade in his old car. And that's how we met. And I wanted to know, we talked and we exchanged information. And then one particular job that I had to do was also to deliver car parts to body shops and other places like that. And one day they had a show out of Toronto that featured nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. I made sure to catch the name of the host of the show so that I could later on get a copy of that audio tape. And that's how I got into MUFON. I talked to Stanton Friedman, and he basically said, well, not just because I'm one of the chair people or chairpersons, but I suggest you use your material and gather everything you have and join MUFON. And I did. And for a while, it went okay. I mean, I was a MUFON member from 1991 till about 2011.
And can you explain to the audience what MUFON is and what it stands for, so for those that don't understand?
MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network, and it consists of people that cover 45 fields of sciences that will actually look into UFO sightings and report about them. But the problem I found was that no one other than the membership itself would get to hear about all the case files, because they would publish a monthly journal, which I love to get. I mean, I have, like I said, a lot of issues from 1991 to 2011, and I scanned them all. I said, this information needs to be put out. You know, like if MUFON has like 70,000 plus case files of UFO reports. And also the other thing is, I find that UFO groups are the worst ones to bitch at the fact that, why isn't anybody believing this? Why isn't anybody looking at the documents, or, you know, knowing that this reality is a reality? Well, it's because they're sitting on information that they should be sharing with the rest of the world. Because when it comes to UFOs, I believe the whole world is concerned. because it's the one question we've been asking ourselves for thousands of years. Are we alone in the universe? And it's a resounding no. The answer is a resounding no. And those groups that have all those journals and case files, it's their responsibility to not only collect the information, but also become educators and use it to educate the rest of the world. So we wouldn't have to be dealing with so much skepticism and debunking.
Yeah, I find that a lot too. That's another pattern that keeps happening too, where I feel the same way, where it all should be shared. But some people kind of want to capitalize on that. And, you know, and I understand that we have certain bills to pay and all that kind of stuff, but it shouldn't be, you know, profited from. It should be maybe a non-profit organization or some other structure so that, you know, we can have a bit of both. But, you know, we had Dr. Jonathan Reed on a couple of weeks ago, and he, when he was going through his major experience, he was in a panic, and he did ring MUFON, and the guys answered him and said, you know, look, we'll meet you at the cafe, you know, tomorrow and blah, 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 and, you know, and we'll help you and everything like that. And they didn't show up. And when he rang the number again, it was disconnected. It turned out to be another number. So there was something going on there too. And this is, I think this is like 1996 or something like that as well. Yeah. So he was obviously intercepted. And some sort of trickery went on there as well. So it's a tricky game that everyone's playing with, you know, behind the scenes and stuff. And we're all trying to get it all out so that we can, you know, just dispel the fear. So what happened? How long were you there for?
With MUFON?
Yeah.
From 1991 to 2011, just about.
Oh, okay. And then, so you were there for a while.
Yeah, but I created the website in 2007 with the help of my late web host, who was also a pirate radio legend from the UK. Yeah, he passed away in a few years back. He gave me all the programs that I needed to create the website, and it was the next step. I mean, me not knowing how to write a book, actually, I said, well, it seems to be a lot easier to set up a website. So he gave me all the material that I needed. And within 2 weeks, I already had like 300 pages of newspaper articles actually written in text. And so it was just copy and paste. And then within 2 weeks in 2007, the website was up and running. But then it expanded for just being Northern Ontario stuff. In the last couple of years, I managed to see, my idea is also to salvage, not just salvage, but also preserve, also, which eventually helps in the sharing of information, also preserve other archival work. Like I found the National Archives of Australia, all their UFO documents, and I took every single bundle and I copied them onto my website because I believe that this is precious history. And if owners of websites do die, and then you lose all that information. So to me, it's better to have it backed up at more than just one location only.
That's really interesting. Did you read some of the archives in Australia, and did Pine Gap come up a lot?
I haven't had a chance to see if it came across, but I've heard a lot about Pine Gap in the past.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised that Pine Gap would be the equivalent over there as Area 51 would be to the United States, let's say. Here in Sudbury, well, a lot of people may not know this, but in 1975, starting in July and leading right up to November of 1975, there was a UFO flyover of five military installations, four of which were in the States. And the fifth one, of all places, was the radar base that we used to have here. And some years ago, a radar technician actually contacted me, and he was on the phone. And a little voice said to me, press the record button. So I recorded his voice, and he basically explains how the radar system worked, how far out it extended, and the day that he was there. He says this was not weather propagation. They blamed it a lot on ice crystals in the clouds or Venus and Jupiter as the cause of the sightings. but they were also witnessed by the military personnel there, including himself. And so there's all these sightings at these military installations. It's the first thing you would look at if you were to discover a planet where there's life. You'd be looking for signs of pollution, which would indicate civilization. And second of all, you would try to investigate, like, what are they, where are they at in terms of level of development or militarization? So you'd look at all the military installations and all of their technical facilities. Like here in Sudbury, I don't know if we're still considered the nickel giant of the world. I think we come first. I think Russia is second in production of nickel, but we have the two we had. They've been bought out by other countries. But we used to have Falconbridge Limited and Inco Limited, and these are two large mining giants, and they're both based here in Sudbury, and so the mine sites in the area is what attracts them here. Not as much military. North Bay, which is mentioned in the bio that you mentioned at the beginning, North Bay is about 2 hours east of here, and there's a military base there. They used to have nuclear weapons in the 1950s that nobody was aware of.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
American armed, but Canadian manned. So it was Canadian soldiers that were at the base, but the nukes came from the States.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You know what? I used to live at the bottom of a mountain on the top. When I Google Earthed it, it looked like an old mining construction and with water in it. And I thought that's probably where some of these spaceships come out. So anyway, look, we're going to get on the other side of the break with Michelle. So stick around, guys, and we can hear a lot more about his UFO experiences. Okay.
Real people, real radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR. Truth Frequency Radio.
We're back, and I'm your host, Nikki Colombo, and welcome to the Nikki Colombo Show, and we're talking to Michelle DeChamps. That's how you pronounce your last name, isn't it, sweetie? DeChamps, or is it DeChamps?
Well, we say Deschamps, but that's okay.
Oh, that's really lovely, Deschamps.
Deschamps, yeah.
Does that mean Michael, Michelle, does that mean Michael of the Champs?
My English teacher used to say that to champs, but no, Deschamps is the fields. If you want a rough translation, apparently the Deschamps family or the Deschamps lineage, I guess, came over to Canada from France in 1762. I'm not sure.
Oh,
yeah.
That is very interesting. I'm very, very into, I've got French lineage as well. It goes all the way back to Hugh de Payne, which was the co-founder of the Knights Templar and the King of Jerusalem. So our lineage goes all the way back 1,000 years, and my mum discovered that, which was absolutely amazing. No wonder I'm so fascinated about all these esoteric topics, but also being a starseed too, I also have gone way off planet and gone all the way back, and I found out that I've got connections to Andromeda, Pleiades, and Sirius, not just one constellation, I guess you would call it. Have you discovered and gone into any of your lineages off-world? And would you consider yourself a lightworker and starseed? Have you had any, you know, like funny marks left on your body or anything like that, or any MyLab experiences or anything like that?
No, that's the odd thing about this whole thing. I've had sightings of the vehicles, I guess if you want to call them that, but I've never seen the occupants, although I do know somebody who has. But no, I've never had regression done. I did want to sort of go back to that first sighting to get to either if I could bring out more detail or to confirm that it really happened. But then I have the documents to confirm that I must have seen something. But no, I don't. It's funny though. The byproduct of having had a sighting or an encounter has made some people telepathic. I know that when I used to buy or get any kind of UFO material, which is inanimate, I mean, I would know almost down to the day when it would show up in the mailbox. It was just weird. I just knew it. Certain things I can sense and other things I'm totally oblivious to.
Yeah, so. You know what? I hear that a lot from a lot of us starseeds and UFO contactees that our ESP tends to go through the roof. And I think it's because, you know, we become consciously aware of everything when, in fact, everything has always been consciously aware of us, but we just didn't know it at the time. And once you start to tap into those abilities, they get stronger and stronger and stronger. What do the occupants look like that you got? You said from your friend actually saw what some of those occupants looked like in one of the ships.
Well, it was actually Don Campbell that told me the story. He's had two encounters with, two encounters or two observations of occupants. It wasn't in an abduction scenario type thing. It was actually one particular time, like he was a skeptic until 1966 when he had a lot of sightings. The sightings were starting to pick up then, leading up to 1967, which was a worldwide UFO wave, 1967.
That's when I was born. Oh, my God. Yeah. Now everyone knows how young I am. No wonder I was born in that year. There you go. Well, thanks for that.
And in one particular sighting that he had, like he was working at Inco. So he was a tradesperson. He was a welder, a master welder, welding different alloys and metals. And he normally worked 4 to 12 midnight, so 4 in the afternoon till 12 midnight. Then after that, he'd go around and get a hamburger. And then when the sighting started, well, he would be keeping track of them. And on this one particular night, I believe he was in his backyard. And he was there with his best friend from work, whom I've never spoken to. And I don't think he would talk to me about his own encounters. But they were both there with a 600 power telescope, and this object came into view. And so he turned the telescope onto the object, and you can actually look right through the porthole. And even though the UFO was brightly lit on the inside, the saucer, you couldn't make out the facial features, but he noticed that four of them were dressed in silver suits and one guy was dressed in black. So he assumed he was the leader.
Did they look human or did they have big heads? Could he see an outline of a big head or did they look more human?
No, not so much. They were upright. They were standing and there was like a large panel of lights and like a control panel right behind them. And so these beings were standing. They weren't sitting at seats or anything like that. So that's what he noticed. But he says they were so brightly lit he couldn't even tell if the heads could have been, because there's so much variation in if you look on my humanoids page on my website, I've actually had to separate the sighting of the occupants from the abduction performing ones, the repeat offenders, as I call them. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know what he actually from one of Leonard Stringfield's status reports that was written in 1990s or the late 80s. There was a sketch in there that closely resembled one of the beings that he saw with his wife. But these other five ones that he saw on board the hovering saucer before it slowly moved away, you couldn't really tell in any of the features because the interior was so brightly lit. But he could tell that the one he assumed was a leader was dressed in black and the other four ones were dressed in silver. the encounter with his wife that he had. He was coming back from his mother's place after having had supper, and where they live now, at the time it was a very lonely subdivision. There was only three homes that were being built, including his. And this weird vehicle followed him up the hill way up to the house. And it looked like a vehicle. I mean, for 1975, though, he says the vehicle looked like a very futuristic looking car, but it made no sound and it had an eerie white glow to it. And the occupant behind the steering wheel looked as if it was poorly trying to disguise itself with this big wig that could just slide right off its head. And the hands were, the hands were covered in blood.
Sounds like a drag queen.
Oh, yeah. Would have been one hell of a weird-looking drag queen, because, yeah.
A drag queen ET, now that's a new concept. Oh, you're going to have to put a new section on your website for that one, please, that's for sure.
Yeah. The surprising thing about that one is that his wife is the one that was more of a skeptic in all this. And yet she's the one who received a telepathic message from the creature, not him. Whatever it said to her, she was passing out, and he quickly got out of the car and went around the other side just in time to catch his wife in his arms. And as the car looking thing moved off, and he wanted to follow it, but his wife had apparently heard about abduction cases back then and said, "No, you're not following that thing, because you never know if you're going to come back or not." So that was one of the regrets that he's had. But he's the one who actually told me to look in the Sudbury Star archives, the newspaper archives, sure enough, he was right. It took me 2.5 years to look through, starting in June of 1947, and I stopped at December of 1989 because then it was too far in between for the next clipping to show up. I was reading more newspapers than I was finding UFO news clippings. So I decided to cut it off at December of 89, and I found over 352 clippings. And it included, I was looking for airship sightings of the 1800s, 1896, 1897. There was a massive wave of what they call these airship sightings in the States and elsewhere. Didn't find anything in the 1800s, but in March of 1914 and 1916, I found two reports. And later on, people would say, well, that was probably planes because, you know, the Wright brothers had flown like on the 5th, on 1905. I said, well, I found a clipping. I didn't photocopy it, sadly, but it said that the first flight from anywhere to anywhere in Canada, at least, was in 1919. So whatever was flying around at night, 1914 and 1916, wasn't ours, especially with the light on and everything else, you know. So and one actually was following the railroad track into Sudbury, and one telegraph operator would contact the next one telling him this object was coming down the line.
You know, I've seen something similar. I was coming home from a gig one night with a friend of mine, and I started to realize once I started talking about this UFO subject that it would actually bring them in. And he had never seen anything like you know, an orb or an actual sighting. And we'd finished very late at night. It was probably about 2 o'clock in the morning. We were driving back to the Gold Coast from Brisbane. And there was this orb right in front of us. And it was leading us all the way down the road. And I said, have a look at that, Tony. See what happens? You start talking about it and they appear. And it just it glided along like a puck on an ice skating rink, you know, doing hockey. It was so, you could tell it was so slippery. And it was like it was leading us all the way down the road. Now, it takes about an hour to get from Brisbane down to the Gold Coast. And so this thing was leading us all the way back home on the road. And here he is, and he's really tall, this guy. He's an ex-musician friend of mine. Here he is, and he's hanging onto the steering wheel, and he's kind of bending over like an old lady looking up at this orb all the way down. And he couldn't keep his eyes off it, and he's talking to me, and his mouth has dropped down to the ground. And I'm like, see, I'm not crazy after all.
That's cool.
Isn't that funny? You know, and we always talk about that experience now. And of course, now since then, he's seen a lot more of them because he's more open to it. And actually, he's the one that actually sent me the radio show with David Icke, and how my after my Kundalini experience, I was just vacuuming, you know, the house one day, and I'm listening to George Norrie, and George Norrie says to, you know, to David Icke, well, how long has this conspiracy been going on for, David? And David says, oh, well, some people might be shocked to hear this, but this conspiracy has been going on for thousands of years, you know. And at that time, I dropped the vacuum cleaner, and I went, who is this guy, you know? And then, you know, from there, I just springboarded off into all this wonderful esoteric knowledge, which is and then led into the more of the UFO and ET stuff, and to the point where I'm, doing my radio show here today. So that's that story. And we've got David Icke coming on in the next couple of weeks, and I can't wait to tell him about that dropping of the vacuum cleaner story. So it was just amazing that, like, all my friends started seeing more and more of it, and they're like, you know, oh, I've seen it. And I was like, you know, you're not crazy after all. You know what? I think I need to get a T-shirt with that on or a bumper sticker. Yeah. What do you reckon? Okay. All right. Okay. Now I'm having a bit of a giggle for myself. The guys in the chat room, you being a bit naughty at the moment, so I'm just going to ignore you with your smutty comments and naughty stuff, because we're talking about some serious stuff here, guys, that's going to, you know, educate people in a subject that is really serious and that keeps blowing open more and more and more and more. I can't believe we're at the stage now where, you know, people are becoming more aware of this subject and not so afraid and more interested in it and not afraid to ask questions. So, okay, so Michelle, tell us about some of the highlights of your experiences. Okay, I've just got a heart now. Yes, okay, guys, just keep it clean in the chat room, please, okay? Tell us some of the highlights about your experiences with seeing UFOs and MUFON and everything like that.
Well, the one sighting that actually made me come out of the ufological closet, I guess you'd say, was my second sighting at the base, at the radar base. But it wasn't at the radar base when I first saw it. See, that very same summer when I met Don Campbell, before that led up to the
sighting. And who's Don Campbell again?
Don Campbell is UFO Don. He worked at INCO. He was a master welder. And up until 1966, he was a skeptic. But then after that, he had several sightings, and so much so that he actually was invited out by the captain of the radar base to go and talk to him. And he did tell me, and I have all the recordings. I recorded every single one of his stories in audio, and I have them on my website. And one particular thing that he was shown by a captain at the radar base was an aerial photograph of a jet coming in, a military jet coming in to land at the North Bay base in the early 60s. It was just a few weeks before they presented that picture to him out of his desk at the radar base. And it showed, I guess the jet was way up high, and as it was coming in for a landing, its gun camera took a photograph or several photographs of these three silver ships with little tiny domes on top. So the photograph actually showed, from what he saw, the tops of the saucers, the three saucers, as they were hovering above the base.
Oh, my
God. So Don had a lot of contacts with the radar base after that, and he'd been on the radio way back when, but a lot of things led up to having lost his recording. His son was home one day, and I guess Don had the tape reel machine set up so he could play back the radio interview he had done. And I guess one day his son and a little friend came over, and they started playing with the recording machine, and they taped over the interview. So Don has no evidence of him ever being on the radio except for the box of the reel. So anyways, with meeting Don that summer, he also had three issues of these old 1960s Flying Saucer magazines. And so I was at the car dealership photocopying them, having access to the photocopying machine. And as I'm done at about 8:30 at night in October of 1990, October 9th, I'm walking to my car diagonally because the way where it was located on the parking lot, And I saw this big bright light in the sky looking south towards Sudbury, because my small town, well, Hanmer, is in the valley, and the valley is north, about 20 kilometers north of the city of Sudbury. And I'm looking south, and I see this object, which would be best described as Jupiter at its most brightest. But the odd thing about this was that it was, if you stood still and looked at it, it was actually gradually coming down and also getting brighter, which gave me the indication that it was coming down at an angle towards my eyes. And then it stopped right over the crest of the hills in the distance, because there's a lot of hills. Well, of course, you know, mining town. And for a while, even the astronauts came here in '70s to train, because it looked like the surface of the moon. We had done so much mining and land erosion because we had cut down the trees to rebuild the town of Chicago in the 1800s, that all the tall trees being gone, well, it just led to erosion. So for the longest time, until they started regreening the area, it looked like the surface of the moon. So I'm looking at the hilltop in the distance at this object, and it's slowly just hovering there, but moving. And then I came back to tell one of the salespeople, I says, there's something flying there, and I'm going to go and check it out. The salesperson looked at it, shrugged his shoulder, and just walked away. I said, okay, well, I guess he doesn't care about it. So as I was driving down the hill, from, because this dealership was located on a hilltop, so I'm driving down towards my parents' house, and I could see the object between the houses in the distance. And then I grabbed my binoculars, and I quickly told my dad, I think there's a flying saucer hovering between Sudbury and Hanmer. I says, I'm going to check it out. And the neighbor was there, and he's kind of smirked and laughed. So I went to a neighboring street, which led into the woods. And being October, where the trees were bare of leaves, there's no leaves on the trees. And I'm looking with my binoculars through the branches, and the object is there. And all of a sudden, I could see it move left to right, like three times. And then it stopped, and then it blinked out. So I thought, oh, shit, there's a branch in my way. So I'm crouching down even lower, and it's not there. And all of a sudden, I see it reappear a little lower, but at a different location. So I said, holy crap. So I said, well, this is BS. I'm in the woods. I should go at another high point, because we have a lot of hills. So I drove to another hill where I could get a better view of it. And by the time I got there, I'm looking around and everything, as I'm driving safely, and I can't see the object. And then I'm panning from west to east, because that location where I stopped, the radar base was located to my southeast of me. And I'm looking west, panning towards the east. And that's when I see this odd light. It wasn't the same thing. It wasn't just a little white egg anymore. It looked like an irregularly pulsating pinkish red light located exactly where the base would be. And the only reason I know the base was, it was exactly over the base, the radar base, is because the lampposts along the highway would show me where the base used to stand. And so I'm looking at this object, and yeah, like I said, it changed. It was a different color. It pulsated not quite like a heartbeat, a little bit more irregular. And my knees started to buckle. So I leaned my elbows onto the roof of my car just to stabilize the binoculars. And I looked at it, and then I thought, stupidly, I thought it was going to be there a long while. So I got back in the car to go get witnesses at the house. And of course, when we came back, it was gone. So I don't know how it took off, if it went up vertically or if it went to a neighboring town, but I dropped off my mom and my brother. And then I went out again to see if I could find the object, but never did. So I've learned a lot in very little time. Like, you can't assume you're seeing a UFO within seconds. You may have to stand outside for an hour and watch how it came in, watch the maneuvers, try to listen for sound. That's why I've created a whole bunch of pages on my website that you wouldn't see anyplace else on any other website. UFO characteristics. What are the 8 or 9 characteristics to look for in a UFO sighting if you think you're having one? Lack of sound, direction of movement, the way it rapidly leaves the area, or the way it rapidly comes into the area. So these are all things that I've learned throughout all these experiences that I've had. And it was important to put it down, because a lot of people, well, especially the naysayers, will say, oh, you just saw something for a few seconds and you think right away it's a UFO. Well, it's on the same token, you look at all the UFO footage on YouTube, and 95% of them are all fake. Why? Mm. because the people who are faking them have never had a sighting. They don't know what UFOs actually look like. They're so plain Jane, you get bored after a while. They don't have all kinds of protuberances or things coming out of them like you'd expect to see on a small scale model used for a science fiction film, for instance. So I'm able to tell pretty well when something is CGI while looking at YouTube. There's certain things, certain sightings have actually perked my interest. I've kept a few where there were supposed UFOs filmed from through the porthole of an airliner by passengers. I have three of those footages on my website. I've asked somebody who's really good with CGI to let me know if I have anything fake on my website, and I would remove it instantly. I usually use old photographs from the 50s and 60s and 70s because, unlike digital photos, they cannot be played with. They have negatives that were tested to death. And that's the one thing I can't find any sense in. You may have somebody today that say, oh, we have new photographic equipment. Let's see if we can't run these old photos through it again. It's as if they're trying to nitpick at something that's been genuinely authenticated as a genuine UFO. And they just won't rest until it's debunked or something. That's the impression I seem to get from all that.
So I've had that too, yeah.
So because of all the speculations that's going on, whether we've been on Mars for the last 40 years, whether or not we have a star fleet or a fleet of UFOs that have been back engineered, I have my doubts about that. But until you can prove one way or the other, people will say all kinds of things. It's the modern day version of the UFO contactees of the 50s, where they could say, oh, I went on a ride on a flying saucer with a Venusian and a Martian. And we hadn't been there yet with probes and rovers and things like that. So until we went there, anybody could say anything, and you couldn't say no or yes. So we're stuck in the same thing, but a more modern day version of it. And I think I'm going to be forced to stay behind with the older data because it's more reliable than anything new that's coming out now, because you got all these people coming up with fantastic stories and there's no backup. There's no evidence. There's no documentary evidence for it. Even the back engineering, I mean, Bob Lazar, I believe Bob Lazar to a T. And when he says that as 1989, we could not duplicate the propulsion system using earthly materials, and this technology may be millions of years ahead of us, not just 400 years or 50 years or 100 years. I have my doubts that we're able, you know, just because you have, like, if they found all these old flying saucers built by the German Nazis, it could be like a concept vehicle. You could have the drawings, all the drawings you want. Doesn't mean that it went into production, you know? Making a drawing is easy. Going from a drawing to actually building the object itself and making it work the way you think it should work, that's two different things. But people don't see it that way. Right away, they'll jump to the Vril technology, the Nazi technology, and then they'll just go rampant from there, you know, with no proof whatsoever. So I was like, oh boy, and it's bad enough that we have the skeptics to deal with and the debunkers without having all these people making up stories that we can't verify one way or the other. Now, whether or not, I'm not saying we haven't come along in a long way. I mean, look at the cell phones we have now. I mean, obviously, if you were to show somebody in the 60s that we have cell phones, they would have thought, oh, wow. But then you look at Star Trek, they have the communicators that more or less looked like the same thing as a flip phone we used to have. I don't doubt that kind of technology, but in terms of large size vehicles that can move silently and do the same maneuvers as real UFOs, I don't believe it. Not for a sec. So,
I'm hearing you, babe. I'm certainly hearing you. Okay, well, we've got another break, and we are going to be on the other side with Michelle DeChamps. And we're going to be talking more about ET experiences. So stick around, guys. On the other side, we're on the Mickey Colombo Show, TFRLive.com.
You are now tuned into the Truth Frequency.
We are TFR. TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio. We'll be right back.
And we are back on the other side of the break, and I'm your host, Nikki Colombo. We are back with Michelle DeChance, and I'll tell you, Michelle really did bring up some fantastic points about integrity there, guys, for our listeners out there on discerning what's real and what's not. Now, through my experience, nearly all of my guests have been targeted in some way for bringing out this information in various degrees. And just as an example, guys, we've just recently, in the last week or two, we've had a guy that had a YouTube channel called Secure 10 that recently admitted that most of his videos about UFOs were CGI, and he had contracts with advertisers and was rewarded with a $300,000 a year paycheck. Now, this is opposed to my guests, including myself, where there is a certain pattern where you can recognize when you start to speak out about this, where this is where discernment comes in and integrity comes in, where the pattern is at first your reputation is challenged, and then the second is your finances are either destroyed or are interfered in some way, and then you realize you've become a targeted individual, and then you know, you have cyber stalking and gang stalking and all that kind of stuff and funny things going on in the house, and then sometimes it might evolve or explode into a MyLab situation where you think that you're actually having contact with ETs, and it's actually the military, and then strange accidents can happen. Your dog might die, or you get beaten up, or all these horrible things happen to you. And so if you look at those two scenarios, that's how you can tell the difference between what's really going on and people's testimonies, because most of my friends have been that are on my show, have been guests on my show, I've been friends with them for many, many years, and we have discussed our experiences together to find out and put the pieces of the puzzle together to find out what's really going on, to make sure that we really aren't crazy. So there you go, guys. And Michelle brought up some fantastic points there, particularly with, you know, the back engineering and the ships and stuff like that, and Bob Lazar. And Bob Lazar was recently on Larry King recently, which I thought was amazing that, you know, a mainstream media outlet would actually have Bob Lazar's, you know, testimony on live on his show to fully blow open what's really going on with all this high tech. And look, guys, I understand that we have to keep some, you know, secrets, you know, with weapons and all that kind of stuff. But when that stuff is interfered, where they are doing MyLab, MK Ultra, and experiments, and you know, and all that kind of, you know, low-level stuff, that's, you know, I kind of draw the line there, because we know that some of us, including myself, have had our DNA and our eggs and sperm taken to be traded off for high-tech and, you know, and the hybrid programs and all that kind of stuff. And that's where it gets pretty dark, and that's where, you know, people get very upset that it's, you know, a violation of human rights and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, we've come to the realization that also, you know, sometimes these experiments are done without the military's consent, and they've got no control of it now because of some of these treaties and agreements that were done years and years and years ago, particularly with Dwight Eisenhower. And I've had Laura Eisenhower on my show, and she goes into and, you know, all of the details about that and how he was tricked as well. And so, you know, we're kind of in a situation now where we just got to take the moment, each moment as it goes, and assess and be discerning, and go on to Michelle's site, which is, what's your website, sweetie?
It's Nuforce, Nuforce, and that stands for Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study.
But wonderful.
It involves way more than that.
And I'll put the link down in the description after the show, so you guys can go onto his site and go through all the files. And have you got pictures? You've got pictures and stuff like that there as well.
I've got pictures. I've got. I did a breakdown. All the links in the margin are all very important pages. I created a page Well, for instance, I have crop circles. So I just basically took a sampling right up to 2005. I haven't really looked at all the latest crop circle patterns since 2005, but I basically put 200 pictures. There are two columns of 100 each, just to go from the very plain ones that were discovered in the late 80s right up to the more complex ones. Another page I have is about Majestic 12. Then I have the interesting pages, which is politicians and UFOs, military officers and UFOs, scientists and UFOs, astronauts and UFOs, cops and saucers, that's police and their own sightings made by police officers, celebrities and UFOs, and then who's who in ufology, skeptics and debunkers. So I have a list of skeptics of debunkers and debunkers, and included the late Dr. Michael Persinger, who was residing here in Sudbury, and he was a Laurentian University professor. He's the one with the magic helmet, as a matter of fact. Some of your listeners might remember he is the one who had a chamber where it had this magic helmet. And basically, he would activate this electromagnetic field around your temporal lobes, believing that he could make you experience similar things to ghost sightings, occupant sightings, whatever. And I always thought it was hogwash. But surprisingly, behind the scenes, turns out he was a believer. He even interviewed Ingo Swann, which is a famous remote viewer. And so it's funny how you have this dichotomy where publicly he's doing something that's demeaning to the whole field, but yet privately he believed in a lot of this stuff. And I work with a young man whose family was friends with his, and that's how I found this out. And yet I always looked to him as being my arch enemy kind of thing, because I even went to one of his presentations and I knew he was going to talk about light phenomena, basically tying into UFOs, because he had always said that Travis Walton got zapped by a ball of light. And I says, no, Travis Walton saw a structured object 90 feet away. You cannot mistake an object at 90 feet away for a ball of light. And the reason why, you know, and I've met Travis Walton a couple of years ago, and I even talked to him on the phone like before the movie Fire in the Sky came out way back in 1993. And I like his story because he's never changed. He's never deviated from his story. That's also why I believe Bob Lazar, because Bob Lazar has never deviated from his story. And so these people here, they have a place somewhere on my website, because I've been fooled a couple of times by people who would show up at my presentations when I started doing public presentations way back when. And I've laid low since then, because we had a fraud that came into town and swindled people out of their money. And his name was Bill Nell. I couldn't find this out before, and I didn't know until I spoke to my colleagues in Toronto, who said, yeah, a lot of UFO researchers are after this guy because he – I don't know if he's claiming to be the son of a U.S. Air Force officer, or he actually is, but he actually would take other people's research and pass it off as his own. Now, for me, I recently got in hot water with a team from Sweden because I had grabbed some of their PDF documents and old publications. We're talking old publications in the 1950s and 60s that obviously people scanned, and I know how scanning, how time-consuming scanning and PDFing documents is, or whatever. But this page I grabbed it from was more like a directory, not an actual website. And so I did not know who to ask permission for. But since then, I've gotten permission when I got myself in a little bit of hot water, because they noticed I had their publications on my site. And the thing I don't agree with what they said was that it's for other researchers for research purposes. I said, what about the layman, the people who want to find out what's been happening in Sweden, what's been happening in Australia, what's been happening in South America? How about those people? You know, UFO information, I know there's copyright laws and when it comes to books. And usually when I find a YouTube video, I will link it to the YouTube, because people are still making money off of their own videos. But a lot of times I like to back up stuff, because if it disappears, and things have disappeared off the internet, there's no doubt about that, you know, very, very crucial videos or whatever, or documents. So And my site says clearly on the bottom of the pages, though maybe it should be announced at the top. It says no infringement, no copyright infringement intended. It's for educational purposes only. I'm not even making money. And whatever money I make off selling my T-shirts, let's say, or the ball cap helps in fixing my car. You know, nobody gets rich off the UFO topic. Oh, except Stephen Greer, which I don't agree with. Yeah. Yeah.
See, David Wilcock.
See, Stephen Greer should have remained a surgeon and do this stuff on the side. Although I do tip my hat to him because he brought all those ex-military and ex-subcontractors to come forward and tell their UFO stories, which is very, very important. But at the same time, nobody gets rich off of this and shouldn't. You know, when it comes to copyrights for books, I believe, that should stay. But thank God government documents are nobody's copyright. The people's taxes pay for the government documents, and so they belong to the people. And that's why if I can't go after old publications, newsletters from UFO groups that are very obscure or you never heard about, I mean, there's even publications on that page of theirs from Sweden that includes a lot of publications out of Australia. And it's fascinating stuff. That's not where I got the National Archives documents, though. I went to the actual National Archives, just like I went to the FBI website, and I grabbed all 16 of their bundles of 1,600 files. Because what if the site goes down? And plus, FBI documents, once they're made public, they're public domain. So, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that would actually convince people of this reality, because the government would not be wasting millions of dollars, wasting time producing documents. There was nothing to it.
Absolutely. You know what? You've crossed a bit of a wire. Like, who owns a sighting? You know, like, how can we trademark our experiences when there's a few other people seeing the same kind of stuff? And, you know, trying to make money out of it, that's a big red flag to me too, because, you know, a lot of people are writing books and stuff. Like, we don't make much money out of our books. We give probably more books away than what we make money out of. Our main intention is to get, you know, the word out there on how to use certain discernment or healing techniques and all that kind of stuff. And, I've actually had photos on my phone that I've taken that have been altered on my phone.
Wow.
And I'm like, and friends of mine have actually sent them to me, and I've sent them to them, and then we go back and look at them, and we're like, okay, someone or something has altered the photos, because what we do is we zoom into a certain photo and crop it and have a look at what's really in there. And sometimes the ETs are actually showing us. They'll say, you know, like, I'll get a prompt to come outside and take a photo of this and that kind of thing, you know. And I know it's ET communication, because I know the difference between voice to skull, because I've experienced that as well. And, you know, you take a couple of shots and then you zoom in and you see more and more and more and more. And then you go back, you know, to that photo a few months later, and what you've cropped and zoomed is disappeared. So... So, you know, and it happens in video as well, you know. Yeah. So we don't really know actually who's doing it, whether it's the ETs or whether it's you know, something else as well. So it's very important to catalog and you know, document everything for our future generations, so that they know what we went through and what happened to us, you know, at the very beginning of this major movement that's, you know, about to blow wide open, and for everybody to see, you know. And then people are going to really question and have an identity crisis and question themselves and question, you know, their religion and everything like that as well. It's going to be one of those most major things. Yeah.
Yeah, I've done that. I've questioned my religion. I was born Catholic. And to tell you the truth, I had the page up for a while, but I don't know if I brought it down. This is what I now believe. I believe that the Virgin Mary was artificially inseminated, that Jesus was one of theirs, but at the highest echelon of any creature, because all he talked about was love. mm-hmm. could do things that we could not do. He could defy gravity, could walk on water, could do all these things. And I don't think they were just made up stories. The other thing that I, in reference to abductions, I believe that one or two, I can't say which ones, because that's where I draw the line. When people tell me, oh, it's this person or that species, nobody knows which species is piloting which ship or which species is doing what. Sometimes, you know, the reptilians are evil. I mean, from what I heard about South America cases, it seems that they've divvied up the planet where certain species have certain territories and the other ones are not allowed to go there. So in South America, you've got the reptilian types. In the Norwegian areas, you've got the Nordics. In Americas, you've got the variations of grays. There's tall, 5 foot tall grays, and then 3.5 foot tall grays. But I believe that one of these two species of these guys actually had their hand in our creation, and the abductions is a way by which they are monitoring our development as we go along. And then to even keep a better watch on us, they have a base on the far side of the moon, and they have bases, a perfect duck blind to keep watch on us while we're not even have access, like visual access to seeing what's there, and also under the oceans. And the sad thing is, because NASA is at least 80% controlled or military run, I'd be hard pressed that we ever find out the truth exactly on what they discovered when they went there with the Apollo missions. And I do believe we went there 6 times, although there's a percentage of the population that believes the Earth is flat. There's a percentage of the population that believe we never went to the moon. Well, I believe we went to the moon because a lot of those engineers are all from Canada. When we closed down, or our former prime minister, Diefenbaker, closed down the Avro Aero project, which was the best jet fighter of the time, we basically gave the technology away to the U.S. because when Avro Aero closed down, most of those engineers went to work for NASA. So if Canadian know-how had something to do with creating the Apollo missions and taking men to the moon, I believe we went there. And they obviously saw something that they weren't privy to tell the rest of the world about. And people have been speculating ever since. So it's a sad thing where our future generations is going to be stuck having to deal with whatever lies have been put forth. And then who's to say that we're not going to be, or they are not going to be, experiencing the same kind of UFO waves that used to come almost regularly every 5 years since 1947?
How interesting. You know, just talking about the moon, you know, when you watch the movie Contact with Carl Sagan, who wrote that, and you look at that movie and you see how that space machine that Jodie Foster goes through and how it blew up because of all that kind of stuff, and how they were filming it live. Now, what I believe is that we went to the moon a lot earlier than what was actually televised on, American TV, only because they couldn't afford to have something not, you know, blow up in their face or something malfunction, because there are a lot of taxpayers there paying for these projects. And so I think what's happened is there is a mixture of fake photos and real photos. And that's what's confusing everybody. The fake photos, the real photos, the photos that are smudged, and the timeline. So the thing is that we did go to the moon, but we didn't go at that time. And there are photos, but some of them have been smudged out, and some of them are fake. And because they had all that simulation stuff with, you know, they had, like, you know, a simulation for the actual astronauts to practice before they went in. You know, they got a lot of that stuff and made out, you know, and used all that simulation stuff to confuse the, you know, the general public. And I just think that was because, you know, there's just no way they would have had something like that live happening on live TV, just in case everything blew up in their face and they lose all their taxpayer money. So I think there's a bit of a clarification there when it comes to the moon. I also believe that there is a base on the dark side, and it used to look like a Nazi swastika. And I'd say that with marbles in your mouth too. And now it's kind of been built out now too. And apparently when we did get to the moon, the reptilians were, you know, in a crater and they were giving us the finger, basically telling us to F off, you know. So here's stories about that as well. So like you said about how there's different ETs in different countries. When I've talked about my experiences when I've seen the greys at the foot of my bed, they're more blue than they are grey. I mean, they're still grey, but they're kind of like a more of a darker blue-grey, you know. So, you know, I'm finding that other Australians are describing them as well, whereas more, you know, in America, they're describing them as typical greys that look like the grey skin from a dolphin. You know what I mean? It's got that kind of that tone to it. So, and that, you know what, guys, there's so many different races out there and so many different, you know, agendas and intentions and stuff. And this is what we're trying to all work out. We're trying to all put the pieces of the puzzle together to get a clear picture of what's really going on. And we have really, despite all the suppression, we have actually moved quite forward, especially in the last 10 years. And that's why, you know, when we bring out all this fantastic information and we've got people like Michelle doing fantastic databases and keeping that all catalogued, this is for our future generations and for us to go back in reference to tie in different scenarios and different experiences and different traits and all that kind of stuff to get a clearer picture, so that, you know, when they finally do decloak and they finally do, you know, reveal themselves on a massive scale, we won't be so afraid seeing them. Because, you know, I can tell you guys right now, whenever you, the first time you ever see a UFO, or if you ever see an alien grey at the bottom of your bed, it changes you forever.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got about 3 minutes until the next break. Michelle, so what do you quickly want to talk about before we have our next break, sweetie?
Well, that's speaking about the alien species, I think there's, I don't know what happened with the landing cases, but it seems like they've gone on to do something else. And I'm not talking about the grays. I'm talking about those first and single time observations. See, that's why I've had to separate those on my website. When you go under the page of UFO occupants, the ones that are there that you first see are, I have these action figures that I got from Florida, and it shows seven different species, including a real Men in Black, which were not even human anyways, although they've mixed it up now, where they're saying that even the FBI agents are dressed in black, so now they're being called Men in Black. Men in Black were totally different. They're all telepathic. Most of those species were all telepathic. Now, if you go down below that, starting in Lima, Peru, February, March 1947, these are all one-time occupants that were seen only one time, and they quickly pack up in their UFOs if they were spotted by accident or whatever. And I have a late uncle, actually, who had an encounter similar to these ones. Now, these ones you don't hear so much anymore about. Now you only have the repeat offenders, which are the abduction-performing ones, you know, the praying mantises, the little grays, the tall grays, the reptilians, the Nordics. And Travis Walton, that's the thing with the movie Fire in the Sky. They never showed the fact that he actually encountered Nordic people as well as the not gray. The ones he saw, unlike the movie where they looked like brown-colored, brown-skinned little gray, wrinkled little men.
The little slitty eyes and the slitty mouth. Yep.
Yeah, his were more like marshmallow, because I asked him about the texture of the skin, and when he pushed it back, it was almost like putting your fingers in fresh bread dough.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'd asked him that way back in 93 before the movie came out on the phone, and that's what he told me. And I said, how are you going to handle the media? He says, I'm just bracing myself for the onslaught. But ever since then, now he's been speaking at conferences, and it takes a while for you to get him talking. Well, me talks more now, but back then he was so quiet, he had to initiate the conversation. And the occupants page is very important, because it'll show people that I've got 85 species on there, including one which was a photograph taken by a police officer in Falkville, Alabama in 1973. The only photo ever taken of an actual occupant. It looks like a guy, a firefighter, wearing an aluminum foil suit, but this thing outran the police car. So But all these sketches I took was from Linda Moulton Howe's book, and I later got permission. Well, I got permission from her to use anything like that, because it's important to show people the creatures that have been seen throughout the world. You know, aside from the ones that are performing abductions, you can't mix the two. My late uncle, he saw something fantastic, and maybe I can get into that really quick after the break.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we've got about 40 seconds left. Isn't this fascinating, guys? To actually, you know what? I would love to get Travis Walton on my show because, you know, when we first saw, you know, my mum and I were watching Fire in the Sky, and we saw those creatures. Oh my God, they freaked me out because they looked so horrific and scary, you know. And the ship was all dirty and everything. And I'm thinking, no way could they be that dirty? Okay, we're gonna be back on the other side of the break.
You are now tuned into the Truth Frequency.
Your protection from deception. TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.
And we are back with the Nikki Colombo Show, and we are having an absolutely fascinating conversation with Michelle DeChamps. And I tell you what, I just want to thank you, sweetie, for documenting all of this for our future generations. It must have taken you ages to put all of this together, you know. And you know what, guys, I really encourage you to go on his site and share. They can share their links, the links on there, can they, with photos and stuff like that? Is that right?
They can email me through the site. Yeah.
Okay. So they email you first and ask permission to send the links of photos and stuff like that on Facebook. Is that right?
I can link it over to Facebook, or you can. They can do anything they want because the site is free access. And my email is actually, you're going to find this funny, but it's the same as my license plate. My license plate on my car is UFO Man. I got lucky with that one. I mean, when I saw Don Campbell and his license plate, UFO Don, I said, well, I'll check with the registry of automotive licensing. And I was surprised that UFO Man was not taken. I met another man down in Toronto who was a senior editor for City TV, one of the television stations there, and his license plate said UFO Guy. And I said, how come you didn't get UFO Man? And he said, well, my wife always called me UFO Guy. And then there's another man who, again, worked at one of the mine sites here. His name is Lorne Johnson, but his license plate says UFO Kid. So I kind of joked that he's my son because he's actually older than me. He's retired. But it's like we have UFO Man, UFO Don, UFO Kid. But anyways,
you're not passionate about this subject at all, are you?
So my email address is UFOMan_1, the number one, @hotmail.com.
Wonderful. Go on.
No, but there's a link to that. It's that same email. I used to have a different email for the website. But it was eventually when my late web host passed away, I was left to try to figure out like how to have two different emails. So I decided to just make it one and the same.
Okay, wonderful. Now, I've forgotten. What were we talking about just before the break you were going to get into?
My late uncle had a sighting just to talk about the kind of things you have to look for in a sighting or a landing, the odd physics that comes with an actual sighting, which can easily distinguish it from a man-made object. This was Christmas of 1981. This is on the side of my mom, my mother's side of the family. My grandmother was there. My cousin Louis, who's a seventh grader, he teaches seventh graders. He's a teacher. And his dad, my uncle, they were all sitting in the living room. And all of a sudden, the living room all lit up in red. And initially, they thought, oh, the neighbor is backing out with their car. And we're talking like, you know, it's winter. And it's very cold. And it's in northern Quebec. That's where I'm originally from. And then we moved here when I was four and a half, 1968. My uncle was telling me the story. And when he told me the story, his eyes just glazed right up. And so you knew that he saw something. And I know it's Christmas time. People are having a few drinks. But he said he took a chance and he looked outside and he said what he saw. And this is the whole physics thing about how different UFOs are from man-made objects. This ball of fire was sitting on the snow. And I don't think he said it was too big, maybe a meter and a half across. And next to it were these two small occupants, like we're talking like 29 inches tall or 30 wow. inches tall. And he says they looked like they were wearing bell bottoms, like the pants that the hippies used to wear in the 60s, because yeah. they would fan out at the base. And I says, why would your attention be brought to anything below the waist? It's because one of the little guys had a probe or a stick, and he was poking at the snow like as if, what the hell is this stuff? and then he says, then the object, as quickly as he saw it, it just left the area. And he says it left so fast, I thought for sure one of the little guys was left behind. But anyways, when they went outside to check, and we're talking like winter, so it's there's snow. They looked all over, and this big red ball of fire never melted the snow right down to the grass. There was no trace of that. There was no footprints. And so a lot of cases, and some of the cases, the classic cases, there's been flying UFOnauts where the beings themselves hover above the ground by 2 to 3 inches, not leaving any tracks. And that's why it floors me when I hear people using abduction cases as a forefront to explain the reality of this, when they should be first looking at sightings and then landing physical trace cases like Ted Phillips has done out of Missouri in the States. I investigated a landing site actually on a place called Manitoulin Island. If you look in North America, you'll see the five Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. Well, Sudbury is just northeast of the Great Lakes, and Manitoulin Island is only about an hour and a half to 2 hours away from here, and it's my Cuba. That's where I go. I don't fly. I don't have a passport, and I don't go to the Dominican Republic like some of my coworkers do. I go to Manitoulin Island. The water is crystal clear. If they had coral reefs there, you'd swear you're in the ocean. The water is that blue, turquoise, whatever. And I go there because there's a lot of UFO sightings. We have First Nation reservations that are there, our Aboriginal, like our Native people, their belief in the sky people goes way back to thousands of years. And
you know, when you ask the Native American Indians and you ask the Australian Aboriginals, where did you guys originally come from? They point to Pleiades. Mm. Yeah, it's definitely a tie there.
And there's also Bigfoot sightings in the area too, which I found out, and that surprised me because I originally thought that Bigfoot was out west in the Rocky Mountains, but he's been all over the place. And mm-hmm. and actually, there was 14-inch footprints that were reported here north of here in a neighboring town called Capriol. And I said, holy crap, I guess the big guy gets around. And he's been linked with a lot of UFO sightings as well, because they seem to coincide in observation of the same locations. So a lot of times, for a while, I think people thought that maybe Bigfoot was something they let off the ship. I even thought that at one time. Or not necessarily an occupant or a pilot, but something that was let loose. But now I believe it's something that branched off of us.
That could be a possibility. I've heard they're very psychic as well. They kind of know, like they can read your auric field. They kind of know what you're thinking or what you're going to do or what kind of moves you're going to make. I know they show up at the East Eddy Ranch a lot with James Gilliland, and they pop in and they kind of play funny little tricks, and they're quite humorous. They can actually tell when someone has got a good heart or not. And so if someone is out there to try and trap them, that's why they can never really, find them or trap them, because they're highly psychic and they've probably got an underground tunnel system that they're, with their big feet and their long legs, they can probably, get to one place to the next in, a couple of hours or whatever, because they're so tall and highly psychic. So there's definitely a tie in that as well. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, you guys have the Yowie, so... I don't know how many reports have been made of that creature out where you guys are, but there's variations. I mean, there's the Yeti in the Himalayas.
Yeah.
There's another creature similar to Bigfoot, but up in Alaska, probably white haired, covered in white. But then there's the swamp thing or the swamp ape, in the Everglades in Florida. So and who knows? I mean, there's so many, we live in an amazing universe and on an amazing planet that has so many mysteries that are yet to be explained. And the sad thing is, even if an historian, for instance, wanted to write a book about history, there's so many missing pieces of the puzzle that's been done by the powers that be because of propaganda and lying to us, that there's no way to portray an accurate representation of our history. And then you've got these UFOs that come into play. I mean, my religious beliefs would have been just okay if it hadn't been for UFOs showing up and all of a sudden, not necessarily destroying my religious beliefs, but expanding on them and realizing that maybe there's a connection there, that there are creators and that, or some of them, not all of them, and they're keeping tabs on us by doing these abductions. So almost by rights, they have a right to access to us, because for all we know, we could be an anthill or lab rats, obviously more evolved lab rats, but I mean, nonetheless, a product of their genetic manipulation and whatever was already living here before, like proto-humans, and just simply came over and tweaked us over time to make us what we are today. Or whether or not it's for trades, we're obviously not on an even keel. So I don't believe that we're really necessarily working hand in hand with them. I mean, we're like insects to them in a way. But at the same time, who knows? I mean, there's a lot of abduction reports where they seem to be showing us something, or how their ships work, or showing us where they come from. But what's the point? Like, where is it going to lead up to, with the military interfering, or the super, super secret group that's in the middle of all this stuff? The people who have known from the get-go that there's been UFO crashes and retrieval of alien bodies and hardware. I mean, whether they know the whole story, I have my doubts, but it's like, to what end? And we're left scratching our heads, whether we're researchers or first-time observers of UFOs, we're on the same page as wondering what this is. And the thing is, it's not paranormal. What's paranormal is our state of mind, because we're still in the cradle. Actually, we've made it over the bars of the cradle, and we're basically exploring for the first time. We're not even space-faring species yet. We're just opening our eyes to this stuff. This stuff has always been normal. It's our state of mind that's paranormal, because we're not used to it. But now we're opening our eyes to it. We're being forced to open our eyes to it.
Yeah, we are. Once your consciousness expands, after you see certain things in the sky or have certain experiences, your consciousness expands and your ESP kicks in and you start to open up and you learn more and more about it. I know that, for me, when you read certain ancient texts, when they were considered gods with a little g, to me they were ETs, because, there were so many different types that were for us. Some of them had different treaties. Some of them were against us. And trying to unravel everything like that is like a big ball of, you know, cotton that's been tied up in loops and loops and loops. And what we're trying to do right now is undo this big, you know, cough ball of tied up loops and unraveling everything. And, you know, it's amazing the wonderful experiences. It's not all bad. You know, we have, you know, malevolent, you know, and we have abductions, but sometimes those abductions are good abductions because they're upgrading us in certain, you know, levels of our consciousness because they're a part of our galactic family. And in some experiences, that's what I've had as well. So we get a little bit of both. But we've also got to learn about discernment so that we, you know, understand what's going on with us. And do you know what? A lot of us have come to a new realization. Now, we don't actually hold those experiences in a negative way anymore. We actually have come to a new understanding about actually what's going on, because at the beginning it can be very frightening. But now you've come to an experience, a new level of consciousness now, where I used to get really pissed off at the fact that, you know, my DNA was taken. But now, you know, because to me it was like a violation of human rights and how dare they and all that kind of stuff. But now, you know how I look at it now, and this is what being a true alchemist is all about, and transmuting something that was negative experience into something positive. And now I look at it as, you know what, I'm the grandmother of a future generation of hybrids, and I find that a bit of an ego boost to my personality now, where it helps me understand and get over these frightful experiences at the time were just absolutely traumatic. And I look at it from a different point of view now, and I go, okay, I get it, you know, and I've made peace with it, and I can kind of move on, you know. So I think that's what's happening now. That's why we do these shows, to bring lots of people on that are authentic, have a high integrity and do a lot of work for humanity to get this information out. And, you know, I really commend you about doing all of that, Michelle. That is fantastic that you've done all that stuff. Taking you probably ages and years to put all this, you know, data together. My God.
Well, I've said this before, and maybe some people don't believe me. It says I may have been born in Canada, and I may live in Canada, but I pledge my allegiance to the planet. And I've said that before, and I'll say it again, because to the alien races, we're one race, one planet, with multiple people, and they gave us the language. And my mom used to get upset. She still gets upset sometimes, because she says, "How come your website is not equally balanced, bilingual, you know, French and English?" I says, "Mom, the terminology mostly is in English, and English is a universal language. And it's the easiest language to learn."
Absolutely, yeah.
And
you know what? It's probably hard for you to actually translate the correct words into French to describe exactly those experiences, because ufology really has certain words and terminologies that really has become a language within itself, don't you reckon?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's so... Oh yeah, there's an evolution in itself when you come to realize that you've had your first sighting and then a second sighting, and I myself never really experienced fear that way. I think the most fearful experience I've had was I nearly drowned about over 20 years ago in July of 1988, and so I'm living on bonus time, and so I'm thankful.
Was that a near-death experience? Do you think?
I saw my life flash before my eyes. I was probably minutes away from drowning, but I got rescued by a vacationing doctor from Buffalo, New York.
Oh, how's that for synchronicity, huh?
Yeah. So it's a life altering experience. And I realized that I can't be arrogant, and I can't be sitting on information like some people do. That's why I won't donate my collection to a UFO group. I'm going to donate my entire book collection, DVDs, whatever, to the local library, because I want it to be accessible to people. Most of the collections, well, it was the same situation for one of my UFO reports, which I sent to Toronto, to MUFON Ontario in Toronto. And it sat in somebody's closet for 3 years. Nobody was using it to even educate people or tell people about my sighting. And I had measurements and everything else. And I have very, very short video, a daytime video and a nighttime video. And I know what I saw and I know what I've got on tape, but it's so short in duration, you can't really use it. But that's when I found out that you can't give your collection to somebody because it may sit in somebody's basement for years and never see the light of day. And I don't agree with this kind of stuff. It needs to be out there, accessible to people. So I'm donating my entire collection. I've written it in my will that the local library branches, there's three or four of them, will get a share of all that I have accumulated. And
that's fantastic. That's so fantastic, you know, because that's similar to what they do with the free energy people who actually those scientists that are out there making free energy devices, and then they patent them, and then they're just held in this patented vault for years and years and years, and they never come out. And sometimes those scientists actually disappear. So it's not actually getting out there because of these powers that were, in brackets, are terrified of us discovering our true power, not only within ourselves, but also with these new fantastic free energy devices that could be, you know, that could change our world. And, you know, it would just be an amazing world to live in, wouldn't it, where there was no poverty and people had free energy and they wouldn't have to pay for their bills anymore. There wouldn't be any wars anymore. There wouldn't be any of that, you know.
Because there's nothing that's divided people more than religious beliefs and ownership of land or property. You know, we don't, like, the First Nation people will tell you, we don't own the land, we belong to it.
There's no separation.
And, you know, and the thing is, it's like that freedom we should have had a long time ago with the free energy. Because hydroelectric power can only go so far, especially in these electric vehicles, which is like, ooh, ah, wow, great. Now, you look at this technology that UFOs have, it's obviously better than hydroelectric. It's obviously better than nuclear. Doesn't leave any radiation whatsoever. In some cases, yes, but very little compared to what we have, you know. And it would be a world-changing event to have that kind of freedom where we'd have as much money as anybody else. You would have no thieves. You'd have nobody wanting to steal your stuff because they would have equally the same things. So it's, I don't know. It's like, I don't know what it would take to change all that. Maybe the presence of the aliens themselves would be enough to scare us in our boots and say, holy shit, there is somebody out there who could kick our asses if they wanted to. And we can't do what we've been doing, which is screw each other over for a piece of the action without having any accountability for it.
You know, you've just triggered me. You know my favorite saying. You know, in the movie Aliens 2, where Sigourney Weaver, she finds out that guy has betrayed them, and she's got him sitting down, and all the other guys are going, "Hey, man, you're dog meat," you know. And then she says, you know, "I don't know who's worse. You don't see them screwing each other over for a percentage."
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That is one of my favorite. That's another one that's going on my bumper sticker or my T-shirt too. You know what I mean? Like, what does it say? I mean, it takes a certain type of person to, when you come into certain powers or technology or whatever it is, that you use it wisely. I know that when my ESP first started to come in and my manifestation skills started to manifest a little bit quicker, I call them my superpowers. You know, I had to realize that, you know, I have to be very careful about and take great responsibility with certain you know, ESP technologies that I discovered within myself, because you can hurt not only yourself but other people too. So you really do have to take responsibility for it. And this is why I feel like I've been here before. I've done all that kind of stuff. I've been there, done that with that, you know, gone into the greed and gone into the selfishness, and I've kind of, you know, transcended all that. And now I'm in a position where it's much easier for me to say no, because I'm like you. I'm for the planet as well. And even though, you know, years ago when I first started having these experiences, I used to feel like I'm an alien on my own planet. And I used to say, I'm an alien on my own planet. And yet, you know, I care about the planet more than the people who are actually originally from here, you know. I mean, like, get your head around that, guys. It's just incredible. You know, we've got to take care of our planet. And these technologies coming in should be, welcomed without any, suppression, so that we can have a fantastic world. I'm sure that there are other planets out there. They don't have money and they live in a fantastic world, which is what we just described. You know, I just really hope that I actually get a chance to actually see it. What do you reckon, Michelle?
Yeah, well, I hope to see it too, because we don't have a place that we can readily move to right now. If, let's say, the planet were to go to the shits, if it's overly polluted, heavily polluted, and as far as surpopulation, I mean, I used to read books in high school about that. I mean, there's still places. I mean, if with technology like that, you could almost terraform the Sahara Desert to have greenhouses and people can feed themselves instead of fighting over pieces of land that are totally worthless, or whatever. Like I said, it would stop a lot of wars if you have the technology to actually regreen, terraform the Sahara Desert and have people grow their own food and be self-sufficient instead of being oppressed by the more powerful people, that the elite or whatever, that have all the cushy vacations and the cushy all the money and the financial backing. I mean, if it'd be all more equal across the board, I think a lot more people would be happier, and there'd be no need for all that misery and poverty and whatever. And so that's got to break loose at some point, because I'm surprised that we've come along this far. Sometimes I even think, you know what? I think humanity's had its run. I think we should just all die out and leave the aliens to take over and bring this planet back to its pristineness.
A reset.
Because we've done an awful lot. We say the aliens are evil, or they're this or they're that, and yet how many millions of people have we killed in the first two world wars, or in any wars in between? I mean,
exactly. And what about Fukushima? I mean, what a mess that is with the radiation. If we had these free energy devices, we wouldn't have all that stuff that would eradicate all that.
And in the States, a lot of those nuclear power plants are actually built on fault lines. Go figure.
Oh, yeah.
So things can happen there just as well as it happened in Japan, easily, And it's like, oh, my God. We're able to produce nuclear power, but we don't have the means and the technology to bring it back to a non-toxicity level where we can put it back in nature. We were really good at building things, but we're not really good and making things, but we're not really good at disposing of them properly.
Cleaning up our own mess too. Okay, so we've got about 30 seconds. I just want to thank you for coming on, Michelle. Thank you so much. And give us your website again just before we finish up to the top 2 hours.
Okay, NUFORS. It stands for Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study. And you can contact me through that anytime. And I was just amazed, and this is a total pleasure for me to have been on your show.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute honor, and I encourage everyone to go on Michelle's site and have a look at the most fantastic database that he's collected.
Hi, my name is Ella, and I'm 10 years old. I'm one of the millions of children born to parents suffering from the sheeple virus. Symptoms include the inability to think for oneself, the attention span of a goldfish, and a strong belief in government and the mainstream media. It is estimated that one out of every two children are being raised by parents infected with the sheeple virus. But there is a cure. For as little as 19 cents per day, you can become a TFR supporter and help children like me get their daily dose of truth. Together, we will make sure every child has protection from deception.